Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's Media Roundtable, we continue our week-long series on the prison system by talking about media coverage of prisons here in the U.S. and abroad. This week, we've discussed how we got to the point of having 2.2 million people behind bars, who profits from the $80 billion prison system, what is life like for the 80,000 young people behind bars, and what real reform looks like. You can find those shows at yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about how the media shape public views on prisons, and we're joined by three journalists who cover these issues. Maurice Chama is a staff writer with the Marshall Project. That's a nonprofit, nonpartisan news organization covering the criminal justice system in the U.S. Maurice's latest pieces focus on suicides in prison. The rates are going up. A feature about Rikers, one of the most violent prisons in the country. It's in New York. And Germany's prison system. Hi, Maurice. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Michael Ames, a contributor to many publications and online news outlets, including Harper's Magazine, Newsweek, and Vice. Michael's feature story on criminal justice politics and policy, Captive Market, ran in Harper's in January, and this month in Vice, he wrote about why he bought stock in the prison industrial system. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And Paul Mooney is a freelance journalist who has reported on China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong, and more recently Burma, since 1985. And Paul has been following news coverage of the arrests of more than 200 human rights lawyers in China. Hi, Paul. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Rose.
Great to have you. So as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note. And give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, Maurice Chama with the Marshall Project, what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
A piece that I think has had a long shelf life that came out, you know, about a month ago now, but that I just keep revisiting because it's sort of so rich is actually by another one of the editors here at the Marshall Project, Bill Keller. He was at the New York Times before starting our organization, and he wrote in the New Yorker about the conservative embrace of criminal justice reform, which I think is something that everyone, you know, has been talking about, but there's a lot of skepticism on the left. There's a lot of, I think, misunderstanding sort of across the political spectrum about the different motivations involved in that conservative embrace, because this is, of course, the same kind of political side of the aisle that many people sort of blame for the high rates of incarceration today. But the way that piece kind of drew out the different sort of strands, whether they're libertarian, whether they're about money, whether they're about, religion, ideas of human redemption, it sort of did a really nice job of piecing out all of these different aspects.
And we'll talk about this later in the show, because we brought this up throughout our week-long series on prisons. But what was the major takeaway from that piece?
I think the major takeaway is that although it's often sort of seen that the conservative interest in criminal justice reform is just about money and saving the state money, and that, you know, enters into a complicated and interesting way that I'm excited, you know, we should talk about later with private prison companies, there also really is a kind of Christian evangelical edge to it. The main subject of that profile, a guy named Pat Nolan, had been working in state government in California for years, and went to prison and came out. And the story really looks at him specifically. And, you know, I think a lot of people on the left are very suspicious of when conservatives say that they believe in the idea that people should be, you know, let out of prison and not given long sentences because they need to have an opportunity to redeem themselves in a kind of Christian sense. But I think that the way in which that piece articulated sort of the depth of that was sort of interesting and new to me.
Hmm. All right. So kudos to Bill Keller, who started the Marshall Project. He wrote this piece for The New Yorker, and that is Maurice Chama. He's a staff writer with the Marshall Project. It's a nonprofit news organization that covers the criminal justice system in the U.S. And Michael Ames, what about you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I think it was technically last week, but I always love reading Radley Balco in the Washington Post, and he brought attention to a story out of Texas about a woman who was pulled over by the police in Harris County and searched. The headline says it all. It was, "In Texas, police search woman's vagina for marijuana." and they claimed that she was carrying 4 ounces of marijuana in her body, which is not only absurd, but gave them the cause to force her to the ground and search her, which is a horrifying story and sadly something not uncommon anymore. And it's just amazing how these stories keep repeating on an endless loop and seemingly not reaching enough people, but an increasing number is the upside to that.
That's pretty horrifying. I just found this story. So Charnisa Corley, a 21-year-old African-American, was driving at about 10:30 on June 21st. A male deputy pulled her over for allegedly running a stop sign. He said he smelled marijuana, handcuffed her, put her in his vehicle, and searched her car for almost an hour. He did not find any marijuana. And then he searched her on the concrete of a gas station parking lot?
Yes. Yes. That's what happened. So, and as far as the media goes, before we go down this nightmare rabbit hole, you know, Radley Balco is a great source, and tends to have a little bit of a libertarian, or I would just say nonpartisan angle to a lot of these issues, and he's also very good at posting some of the latest police outrages, whether it's this story or raids into people's homes that kill people's families' pets, and his blog is a good place to go.
I mean, this man actually forcibly penetrated her. So when you get stories like this, it seems like the media now are doing a really good job of exploring these issues and finding out, how did this happen, how often does this happen, and is this even legal?
I'd say they're doing a better job. And, I mean, I had a source for another story, and I was talking with him, and he said, oh, you know, this has been going on for years. The only difference is now it's finally getting is people are getting caught for doing these things.
Right.
And and perhaps we'll have to go through a period of time where this creates more tension, but, you know, a sunlight on the darkness can only help in the long run, avoiding things like what happened to this young woman in Texas.
Charnisa Corley, and we'll talk about that later in the show, just about the fact that these issues are getting more attention. So kudos to Radley Balco at the Washington Post. The headline, "In Texas, Police Search Woman's Vagina for Marijuana." And we'll put a link at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for that, Michael. That's Michael Ames. And what about you, Paul? Paul Mooney, what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Yeah, there was a massive explosion in the coastal city of Tianjin in China on August 12th. And the police blocked off the area. More than 100 people were killed. Dozens are missing. 600 people were hospitalized. And a Chinese journalist, He Xiaoqin of the Beijing Daily, at great risk to himself, managed to sneak into the area and spent the day reporting on what he'd seen. It was just really kind of a very sad story. And he told it in a very kind of a personal and moving way. He described smoke rising from broken buildings, thousands of vehicles destroyed by the explosion. He also talks about a purple, he shows a photograph of a purple teddy bear on the floor, a frightened dog scurrying away, personal belongings of people from the homes that were destroyed scattered around the sidewalk. And he, you know, his newspaper couldn't run the story, so he used his mobile phone to put up photos and the story on WeChat, which is a social media platform very popular in China.
Huh.
Fellow journalists saw it and then started coming into the area as well. And so, you know, this is a very good recent example of how Chinese journalists are fighting back against state controls to report important stories.
And Paul, why did he have to sneak into the site?
You know, this happens every time there's any kind of disaster in China. The government sees any kind of reporting as negative, or a negative reflection on the Communist Party, and so they'll keep journalists out. Whether it's an earthquake or flooding, this is often what happens.
And then why wouldn't his media outlet publish the story?
The government announced, shortly after the accident, the government gave an order to all the media. All the media in China is controlled by the state, saying that media could only carry reports that came from the official New China News Agency.
And so do we know how this happened?
We're not sure. They haven't actually said yet. But the problem was worsened by untrained or inexperienced firemen actually coming in and using water on the chemicals to put out the fire, and apparently that created other explosions.
And just quickly, what can you tell us about this area? It's a port, one of three major locations in China through which the country imports a wide array of products.
Right. Also an industrial zone. There are a lot of factories. I guess it's very close to the coastal areas for shipping reasons. So there's a lot of factories. Also, one issue is that there probably shouldn't have been people living that close to this type of factory. So it points out to some shortcomings of the Chinese government in kind of regulating industry in China.
Well, it sure is getting a lot of media attention. I just was searching for it, and it's getting a lot of headlines. So
Right. Kudos
to Ho Xiaochen. And how can we find his reporting?
The original reporting was in Chinese, and an organization called China Digital Times has done a translation. I can send you the link for that.
Okay, great. And we'll put that at yourcallradio.org. So, Paul, let's dive in and talk about China and the arrest of the human rights lawyers. But before we do that, we've been doing a week-long series on the prison system. And when you look at the United States compared to other countries. So the U.S. has 5% of the world's population, 25% of the world's prison population, 2.2 million people. And when you read stories about how the U.S. compares to other countries, China always comes in at number two with 1.7 million prisoners. So how do you think we should understand this? Do you think the figures tell the whole story?
In China, it's always difficult to know. You can't trust any kind of statistics from there. So I think it's difficult to really know what the true situation is. In many cases, there's an expression in Chinese, to be disappeared. It's because people are kind of picked up off the street and hoods are thrown over their heads, are taken away. And sometimes for months, their family doesn't know where they are. So I think the numbers might be hard to really kind of to understand in a place like China.
And we've been hearing from the guests that have been on this week that sometimes it's really hard to get into a U.S. prison. Other times it's not so hard. It depends on, what you're focusing on, who your contacts are. What is it like in China to gain access?
It's almost impossible. I've only heard of one or two situations where foreign journalists were allowed to enter prisons. What I know about the prison system in China comes from some very well-written books by our memoirs by people who'd spent time in prison.
So should we assume that there are more people in prison than the 1.7 million that we see cited in articles?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the source is for that, but if it's a Chinese government source, then I'd imagine it could be much higher than that.
Hmm. And so what can you tell us about what's happening with the crackdown of human rights lawyers? The New York Times reports that in what lawyers call the most withering political assault on their profession in decades, the Chinese government is mounting a broad crackdown on human rights lawyers, contending that they have exploited contentious cases to enrich themselves and attack the party. And the Times reports that 200 lawyers have been detained and 20 are still in custody.
Right. Yeah. This is, since Xi Jinping came to power, he stepped up pressure on civil society. The crackdown on lawyers is unprecedented. We've not seen anything like this since the legal establishment was came back in 1980. In recent years they've gone after. Bloggers, cyber citizens. They've gone after NGOs. The Christian churches are under attack now, and what we call human rights lawyers are just the latest target. And it's basically because they take on cases that the government doesn't like or that the government feels it's embarrassed by. And so, I think this is the final blow of Xi Jinping trying to really kind of control the whole narrative in China.
And so what is the media attention of this issue? How is this being covered in China?
It's completely controlled by the state. The media has really slandered these people. Several of them have been seen on CCTV, the state broadcaster, making confessions on TV. In one case, the woman, later said she was forced to make a confession. These are people who haven't gone to trial yet. they haven't even seen their lawyers. Some of the people that are still detained of the 22, we don't know where they are even. We don't know what charges are being brought against them. And so for the media, it's kind of sentencing by the state media, essentially. And there's no independent media in China to offer any kind of counter view.
The Times also reports that the government is focusing on the Fengrui law firm in Beijing, which has represented the dissident artist Ai Weiwei, and also Cao Shunli, a human rights campaigner who died after reportedly being denied medical care while he was in police custody.
Right. And also they've defended they were actually in the process of defending some Falun Gong practitioners. And they also defended a Muslim scholar, Ilham Todi, who was given life in prison on basically trumped-up charges. So Feng Rui took on a lot of sensitive cases.
Paul Mooney is a freelance journalist who's reported on China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong, and more recently Burma since 1985, and he's been following the arrest of more than 200 human rights lawyers in China. We're also joined by Michael Ames, a contributor to many publications, including Harper's, Newsweek, and Vice, and Maurice Chima is a writer with the Marshall Project, a nonprofit covering the criminal justice system in the U.S. And Maurice, what are your thoughts on this story? Because you know, it's so hard for journalists to get access to prisons in China. And Paul was just telling us that we don't really have that much information about what's happening with these lawyers. So what are your thoughts on this? We just don't really get a good picture of what's happening in China on this issue.
It's true, we don't. And I would just sort of pivot to say that the situation in America when it comes to jails and prisons is better for journalists, but it is certainly not as much better as you might expect. I've certainly encountered over the course of the past few years an incredible sort of variety in terms of how much different prison systems in the U.S. are willing to let journalists in, and the same is true of jails. And I think that you find in a lot of countries, you know, there's a sort of an assumption that the, you know, how repressive the government is on a lot of levels is going to sort of affect how it deals with media access to jails and prisons. But in the U.S., I think over the past 10, 15, 20 years, there's been a real kind of closing of prisons and jails in the U.S. as well, to where reporting on them becomes a real challenge in terms of, you know, having to kind of piece together stories, you know, like Mr. Mooney said, from the memoirs of people who've been inside, from talking to those people, from exchanging letters with them to the extent that's ever possible. It's a much more kind of piecemeal process, both in China and here.
And Michael, what would you add to that?
Well, I would say that I would agree with Maurice that it's better here. But obviously, wardens of prisons and state agencies can exert as much control as they want, and it really sort of depends. It's a bit of a case-by-case issue. You know, there's places where there's more openness and other areas where it's a total crackdown. So better than China, for sure, but improvements can always be made.
And according to China Change, I just wanted to read this brief section about these lawyers who are fighting for free expression, religious freedom, food safety, economic changes, political rights, wrongful convictions, and the rights of people with disabilities. So just to give people a sense of who's being arrested here. And Paul, finally, last question. When we've been talking also about labor and how some prison facilities in the United States are paying people like 20 cents to a couple dollars a day to do a variety of work. And China historically has used prison labor. According to the Prison Legal News, in Chinese jails, prisoners begin working on their first day of detention, regardless of the circumstances. What do you know about that?
It's well known that everyone in the prison system in China has to work, and the conditions are quite bad. They work very long hours, sometimes, and also in the very difficult conditions. So it makes a bad situation worse when prisoners are subjected to this type of treatment. Mm.
And Paul, what are you working on right now?
Right now, I'm working on a series of stories about how the Chinese government reaches into the United States to intimidate, harass, or try to manipulate citizens of China who are here, Tibetans, Uyghurs, Chinese students and scholars, just various people. The Chinese government exerts great pressure on Chinese citizens living in other countries, often using family back home as hostages to get people to do what they want. One Uyghur journalist from Radio Free Asia in Washington, his three brothers were arrested earlier this year. That's one example.
Well, how pervasive is that in the United States?
It's quite pervasive. I spent a month traveling around the U.S. talking to Chinese people, and everyone had stories like that to tell.
Well, thank you so much for your reporting, and thanks for joining us. Paul Mooney is a freelance journalist who's reported on China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong, and more recently Burma since 1985. He's been following media coverage of the arrests of more than 200 human rights lawyers in China. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Rose.
And you can find reporting about this issue. We also found a report from the BBC called Why is China's Female Prison Population Growing? And you can find links at yourcallradio.org. And joining us for the rest of the hour is Maurice Chima. He's a staff writer with the Marshall Project, a nonprofit that covers the criminal justice system in the United States. And Michael Ames is a contributor to many publications, including Harper's, Newsweek, and Vice. And Maurice and Michael extensively cover the U.S. prison system. So let's talk sort of a general question, because prison reform and high incarceration rates, Black Lives Matter, and the issues they're focusing on with the prison system is getting so much attention. And so first off, what are your thoughts on the role the media are playing in really elevating the national conversation and bringing attention to these issues? What are your thoughts on that, Maurice?
Well, I think that the media, as a sort of, I mean, a huge conglomeration of different publications, tends to be, you know, very centrist, and the kinds of things that you see reported sort of in the media a lot tend to be kind of the same things that people are interested in reading about. You know, editors are thinking about their audiences, and I often think about the fact that a lot of the crimes that spurred the really harsh laws that led to such dramatic levels of incarceration that we're seeing today were really spurred by media reporting in the 80s and early 90s about these sort of horrific rapes and murders that kind of sensationalized them and did not point out how rare these rapes and murders were, and this led to a kind of public panic that spurred legislators in a lot of states and at the federal level to increase penalties and lead to the kind of boom in incarceration that you see today. And now I think that the pendulum is kind of swinging back, where you know, journalists are finding individual horrific stories of things that are happening to people in prisons and jails, and that is leading the public and legislators to kind of rethink some of those laws, and you're sort of very slowly starting to see them unravel and get closer scrutiny.
And what are your thoughts on that, Michael?
Well, I would agree with Maurice about the media being a many-headed beast, and it's a massive organization, so it's hard to, or not an organization, it's a massive disorganized conglomerate of voices in the country, and increasingly it has you know, the centers of the media have less power, and these voices from the sides are gaining prominence, which is helpful. I think a great example from this week was when the video surfaced of Hillary Clinton speaking backstage with some Black Lives Matter activists. Mm-hmm. And that was a really interesting video that I don't watch nightly news at home, which is still you know, receives much higher viewership than cable. And as far as seeing a clip like that, I don't know how much that penetrated to what we would call the mainstream media, but it was really fascinating. Maurice, did you see that clip?
I did, yeah, and I think that it's sort of totally symbolic of the way that kind of the rise of social media and the fact that everybody has a camera, it can lead these stories to percolate, you know, into kind of across social media and then even sometimes hit mainstream media. You sometimes see YouTube videos like that on CNN, on MSNBC, which seems like not something that was happening 5 or 10 years ago.
And just to let people know who weren't following this, so members of Black Lives Matter went to a Hillary Clinton rally, and they were told that there were too many people in the room and you can't get in. And so they, of course, got angry and wanted to disrupt the meeting. Well, the Hillary Clinton's people obviously didn't want them to disrupt it, so they said, well, wait a minute, why don't we give you like a 5-minute chat with Hillary Clinton after she's done? And so three people with Black Lives Matter talked to Hillary Clinton, and someone videotaped it, and now it's getting a lot of attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and from a political standpoint, it was really a wonderful moment, because Hillary Clinton, it was the least scripted, the least guarded that Hillary Clinton has looked comparatively to, you know, when she goes on a national camera. And it was, she was animated. She seemed to really want to talk about these issues in a sort of hard-nosed political way. And I think, I mean, the lesson to take out of it is, for Hillary Clinton's people, it would be great if she spoke like that more often, even when she was speaking to a camera. And for other media outlets, is there should be more of a pursuit of finding those moments from politicians.
Yeah, I actually had the sort of privilege to see some of those moments on a recent trip to Germany that I took with a group of corrections officials and politicians who were touring German prisons and talking about reform in the U.S. And I was really struck by the way in which, you know, political figures who are very, very careful in front of the media most of the time, in this kind of specific bubble where they were all kind of abroad together in a foreign place, feeling a little bit uncomfortable, were very sort of open and vulnerable about the challenges of criminal justice reform in the U.S.
And so talk a little bit about that trip, Maurice. How did that come about?
Sure. Well, there's a think tank in New York called the Vera Institute, and they basically had this idea that corrections professionals in the U.S. could learn something from visiting prisons in Europe. Europe, of course, has much, much lower rates of incarceration and also much, much lower rates of crime. It has a very different system of laws. People don't really spend any more than 5 to 10 or maybe 15 years there, even for very serious violent crimes. And although in some ways, you know, it's hard to compare apples to oranges with these different countries, the idea was, because we're in a kind of particular moment right now, what we call, you know, a lot of people like to call an emerging consensus, in which the right and the left and libertarians and liberals are all kind of coming together and talking about criminal justice reform, it would be sort of an opportunity to put a bunch of those people together with these guys who run prisons, a couple of district attorneys, and send them all over to tour these German prisons together and make them into a kind of make German prisons a sort of centerpiece at the table to talk about what we can do in the U.S. One of the people who organized the trip with the Vera Institute said that, you know, whenever little kids go over to a sleepover at a friend's house, they come back and they say, well, wait, why do we eat dinner at 6 o'clock? They eat dinner at 7 o'clock. And the thought was that maybe we would, this was going to spur creative thinking about the prison system in the U.S. And it really did.
I was
surprised.
Hold that thought. We'd love to hear about
you
saw there. Today it's our media roundtable, and we're talking about media coverage of prisons. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, where you'll also find links related to today's show.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will have a conversation with the founders of Voices of Witness, an oral history project and book series that depicts human rights injustices through the stories of the men and women who experience them. How do human stories elevate our understanding of the world we live in? That's on Monday. If you have a show idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it is our media roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news, and we're rounding out our week-long series on the prison system by talking about media coverage of prisons, both here in the U.S. and abroad. We're talking about this with Michael Ames, a contributor to publications including Harper's, Newsweek, and Vice. His feature story on criminal justice politics, Captive Market, ran in Harper's in January. And this month in Vice, he wrote a piece about why he bought stock in the prison system. We'll talk about that in just a bit. And Maurice Chama is staff writer with the Marshall Project, a nonprofit news organization covering the criminal justice system. And we're talking with Maurice about the trip he took to Germany to look at their prison system. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. Prison reform is getting so much attention now in the U.S. So what are your thoughts about the reporting and the solutions that you're hearing about, the voices that you're hearing or not hearing? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. So, Maurice, your story, Germany's Kindler, Gentler, Safer Prison, it almost makes your eyebrows just raise, because you write about the fact that inmates in Heidergreen prison...
Heidering,
thank you. The inmates live in rooms and sleep in beds, not on concrete. They have privacy. Correctional officers knock before entering. They wear their own clothes. They can decorate their space as they wish. You write that corrections officers are drawn primarily from the ranks of lawyers, social workers, and mental health professionals to be part of a therapeutic culture. And then Greg Markenthal, the corrections secretary of New Mexico, said, "Find a security camera. There aren't any." When he heard that prisons in Berlin have 33 physicians to care for 42 inmates, his response was, "Good God." That's a ratio of about one doctor for 127 prisoners. And you point out that in Virginia's prison, there was one doctor for every 750 inmates.
Right. I mean, there are certain things about the German system that were totally shocking in the way that the just entire kind of philosophy behind what they're doing is very different. You know, over the first few days, there was just a lot of surprise. Over the past few years, there's been some really good reporting. There was some in the New York Times Magazine about Norway's prisons. It made a similar point that, in Europe, you go into these places and there are ceramic toilets rather than those metal bowls, you see bolted to the wall in American jails and prisons. There's tons of light coming in through windows. The whole environment just feels very alien. But over the course of the week, we sort of came to realize that these are just symbols of the way in which the system there is just more oriented around rehabilitation, that the people who run prisons in Germany see their role as not to punish. The word punishment never comes up. They really see it as to take people who have screwed up in one way or another, who've in some way kind of contravened society's understandings of what correct and lawful behavior is, and help them get to a point where they're not going to do that again when they get out. So the whole kind of mindset is very different, and I think you see elements of that mindset here. Rehabilitation is something that gets talked about a lot, but actually Greg Markenthal, the corrections secretary of New Mexico, after the trip, he told me, we have both of these philosophies in America. We have the punishment idea and we have the rehabilitation idea, and we really have to like figure out which one we care about and want. And I think this Germany trip kind of came at a perfect moment where I think around the country, a lot of the different media reporting on the criminal justice system is sort of forcing that question of what the sort of deeper societal values that undergird our prison system really are going to be going forward.
And what about that, Michael? Because, we're having this major conversation about prison reform in this country. And our guest yesterday, Darris Young, was talking about the fact that he feels like the conversation ends once the person gets out of prison. And then what happens? He says that's the conversation we need to be having.
Right. Well, just to respond a bit to what Maurice was talking about, I would say the political conversation, just due to the political reality today in Washington and around the country, is the conversation would end as soon as people heard the word Germany. or Europe. You know, I mean, there's no doubt that we can learn from other countries. The problem is the realities of American politics and the reluctance to openly say that we're going to learn from other countries. So I'd be curious to see how the lessons learned from that trip and for the, you know, how the Institute in New York is going to message that and work across the aisle, or maybe it's not that should be partisan, but work with the conservatives, the reform-minded conservatives on this.
It's going to be interesting to see, too. I mean, a lot of the people who went on this trip are going to be doing a congressional briefing in October, so we'll sort of see what the response is then. I also think that you have an interesting divide between corrections people who tend to be appointed, and so they're not, I mean, they're responsible to the people that appoint them, and those people are elected by voters, right, when you're talking about governors and legislators who appoint these people. But I think they also see themselves as kind of technical experts who, even if they're not going to openly say, oh, yeah, we got this idea from Germany, there are ways in which individual practices, they can kind of use this language of like, oh, well, this is just a best practice. This is just something we know works to make sure people don't commit more crimes. And I found that a lot of the conservative people on the trip, the guys who were in corrections agencies who, you know, tend by nature to be fairly conservative, said things like, well, you know, it's really hard for me to sell to politicians here the idea that we just want to make prisons better for people because humane prisons are just a more decent thing to do. What we need to do is show them that, you know, prisons that have a lot of sunlight or that allow prisoners to wear their own clothes or whatever it is, make it so that they come out of prison and are less likely to commit more crimes, and that they can kind of make an argument based on public safety. And of course, public safety is sort of what got us here in the first place as an argument, and we know that no one really doesn't support that. So they kind of try to find areas where they can frame what they're doing in terms of something that everyone can support, if that makes sense.
And Maurice, that jail that you visited, the people who are behind bars at that jail, what are they in for the most part?
All manner of different crimes. I mean, some of them had stolen. A lot of minor crimes in Germany that are nonviolent don't even lead to prison time, or they lead to time at these institutions called open prisons, where you can go to work during the day so you don't lose your job. And then your punishment is basically just that every night you have to go home and sleep at the prison, which is like unthinkable in the U.S. here. I mean, it's sort of more like what we think of when we have halfway houses. But some of these men were in for murder and rape and robbery, very, very serious crimes. But the assumption was that they could be sort of analyzed and assessed and understood by mental health professionals, and that after 5 years or 10 years or 15 years, they could come back to society and be less likely to commit those crimes again. There was also a very interesting program that I encountered in Germany that was called preventive detention, and this was for a very, very narrow set of people who, despite all of the rehabilitative programming they got in prison, you know, it was still felt that they could pose a risk if they were to get out, and so these people could kind of be held indefinitely, and maybe every 6 months or a year their case would be sort of brought back up. And it was what one corrections officer from America referred to as a safety valve, where you could create a much more sort of rehabilitation-oriented prison system, but not sacrifice the idea that there really are a handful of people out there who scare everyone and who can't just be let out after 5 years.
And are these all government-run prisons, or are any prisons private in Germany?
No, it's all completely government-run. There are specific things within the institutions, like food, that might be privately run through contracts. But, you know, when we told prison officials about the kind of profit motive involved in a lot of American corrections, they were sort of flabbergasted that kind of thing could exist.
Maurice Chama is a staff writer with the Marshall Project, a nonprofit news organization covering the criminal justice system, and he has a number of articles about the trip that he took to Germany. I hope you can check it out. Find the links at yourcallradio.org. Michael Ames is a contributor to many publications, including Harper's, Newsweek, and Vice. And Michael, you wrote a piece in Harper's about how, you know, administration after administration passes laws for harsher sentencing. And what's so interesting about where we are now is I keep thinking about Kalief Browder, you know, the young man who was picked up for allegedly stealing a backpack in Queens. His mom couldn't afford $3,000 in bail. He was sent to Rikers, a very violent prison, one of the most violent in the U.S. He was there for 2 years, 800 days in solitary, got out, never tried, all charges dropped, 2 years to the date he was released, he committed suicide. Now, because The New Yorker wrote this long profile about Khalif before he committed suicide, so many outlets, to ABC News, you name it, covered this. And then we got a law changed in New York, so no more solitary for 16 and 17-year-olds. They're trying to do the same thing in California. Senators Cory Booker and Rand Paul have introduced a federal bill on this issue. And you have written a piece about how, you know, the system isn't broken. It's working exactly as it was designed to work. So what are your thoughts about where change comes from? Because it seems like the Khalif Browder story really launched major changes on isolation.
And that's a wonderful and rare example of where media attention can create change. Where an isolated individual media piece led to change. The writer and the editors at The New Yorker deserve all the credit in the world for that. Unfortunately for him, it was too late in his life. But look, I think the media can help, especially when there's this chorus that we're hearing now of so many similar voices writing about these injustices. And ultimately, politics. I mean, you know, a lot of people said that story in Harper's was incredibly depressing and overly cynical. But I was just trying to tell it like it is and how slowly politics moves on these things and which directions politics moves in and for what incentives. And political incentives frequently are political incentives. They're not policy incentives anymore. And no matter how much this conversation is growing in the country, the political incentives are still more or less the same. And that is the Willie Horton moment is with us forever. It set a template in American politics that made any politician more afraid of looking soft on crime than was worth the risk of looking like a reformer.
And for your piece in Harper's, you went to Washington to talk to politicians of either party who would speak on the record about criminal justice. Who was willing to have a candid conversation with you?
Rand Paul was the only politician who was willing to meet with me. Notably, Senator Chuck Schumer, a Democrat, on the far other side of that spectrum, didn't respond to any questions. And I think that there was a real lesson in that kind of breaks down expected political divisions on these things. Rand Paul introduced and has signed on to more criminal reform pieces in the Senate than any other member, senator currently, over a half dozen. And Chuck Schumer, meanwhile, is not getting behind the Smarter Sentencing Act, and is, if anything, has pushed in the last several years for more mandatory minimum. And he just is playing by the old playbook, which, there was an anecdote in the story of a mandatory minimum for purveyors and sellers and dealers of designer drugs. And Rand Paul put a hold on that bill on the principle of no more mandatory minimums because they create more problems than they solve. And Schumer and Rand Paul got into a pretty heated fight over this through back channels, and I was told by sources that it got pretty ugly. And when Schumer reached out, he started using the levers in the press, and he had the New York Post, his office tipped off the New York Post to interview this woman whose son died in a car crash, I forget if it was a car crash or overdosing on designer drugs. But the woman's quote, the money quote in the New York Daily News, was Rand Paul has blood on his hands, and the politics of these things are still emotional and somewhat easy if politicians want them to be.
Hmm. And you report in Harper's that Rand Paul has introduced 5 pieces of legislation in the Senate in 2 years, which addresses issues ranging from felon voting rights to civil asset forfeiture. When you talked to Rand Paul, what did he tell you? Why is he introducing these bills? Why does he spend so much attention on this issue?
He became really animated on this. He seems genuinely outraged. And I did a story earlier for Harper's on Ron Paul's influence on young conservatives and on libertarianism as a growing trend in the conservative movement. And I think Rand Paul is animated by those same concerns. I mean, like Maurice was saying earlier about the Christian element of prison reform, there's really 3 main conservative elements that's being pushed from conservative prison reformers: fiscal, libertarian, and Christian. So fiscal is this costs too much money. Libertarian is this is an authoritarian nightmare to submit human beings to this treatment. And third is Christian, that people deserve a second chance. And my sense was that Rand Paul believes genuinely in each of those things, and talks about people who he knows. I mean, a lot of people in reform circles base this on personal anecdotes. So Rand Paul talked about a child of a friend of his who couldn't get into the military service because of an arrest, a nonviolent drug arrest. He's been working with a strong lobbying group for reform in Washington called Families Against Mandatory Minimums, whose founder was motivated to get into this because her brother was sentenced to an unbelievably long prison term for nonviolent growing marijuana plants. Pat Nolan, who Maurice mentioned earlier, served time in federal prison for breaking federal election law, and now he's made this his life's work. So I think it's a kind of Bernie Kerik is another example. He was indicted and served his time, and as soon as he got out, he made prison reform his own crusade. And I think all of these prove that when people see the realities of the criminal justice system up close, and mainly I'll say when white people with money and access to power and media see the criminal justice system up close, they are in a much better position to do something about it than for people who have no voice or access to power.
Did you talk to Rand Paul about the services that are provided or not provided inside and outside of prison? Because we also talked about that, especially on yesterday's show, about reform. You know, even in a state like California, the services are pretty dismal.
I only had about 20 minutes with him, and we didn't get into that. We were talking more about the politics of reform and why the bills weren't passing and why the reform was being held up. So we didn't talk about those specifics. We did talk a bit about privatization of prisons, and you know that's a tough one for someone like Rand Paul because on one side, they don't want government control over everything, but I would refer to another source in the story, who was Grover Norquist, another prominent conservative anti-tax man. But he said, look, we made a mistake in thinking that if you can leave prisons to the wardens, then everything will be okay. He said, no, there are certain things that the government needs to maintain a foothold in, and prisons is one of them.
Hmm. What are your thoughts on this, Maurice? Because the theme that came up this week is that these very conservatives who are pushing for reform are the very people who want to cut all of these programs. I mean, you can even go back to when children are young. I mean, they're cutting programs that these kids need, you know, especially kids who grew up in poverty.
Right. I mean, I think that there are a lot of kind of internal ideological contradictions. I think Michael did a really great job of laying out these sort of 3 pillars, the libertarian, fiscal, and religious, for lack of a better word. And I think that there are obvious kind of contradictions between them and tensions that we're going to kind of see play out over the next few years. You're definitely going to see the kind of conservative, the fiscal conservative element represented by, you know, Grover Norquist that's interested in keeping the cost of the kinds of programs out in the world that would keep people out of jail and prison, better education, better mental health services, better, you know, anti-poverty programs. these sorts of things would help alleviate the burden on the criminal justice system, and some conservatives might not really be willing to go there. They're more interested in shortening sentences, decreasing the penalties for low-level drug offenses. So I think we're in the sort of moment where, and the 2016 election will probably bring some of them to a head, because it's an issue that is being brought up. Rand Paul didn't mention criminal justice at the Republican debate a couple of weeks ago, but Kasich, the governor of Ohio, did. You're starting to see it hit at the higher levels of discourse. I also wanted to jump on the question of privatization, and that was, I had an interesting conversation with Greg Marcantel, the New Mexico prisons chief that we've been talking about privatization, and he sort of made the point that at this point, private companies have such a strong foothold in incarceration and in corrections that it's sort of too optimistic for these sort of practically oriented politicians to completely dismantle that system, but that sort of behind the scenes, pushing for greater oversight of those companies and greater, you know, scrutiny on the ways in which they're forced to comply with contracts can actually have a really great effect in terms of helping just individually daily lives of prisoners.
Because they are so closely aligned with politicians, right? I mean, when they sign these contracts, the governments have to keep the beds filled in many cases.
Yeah, there have been lots of problems with that. And, I mean, as Michael's reporting has really sort of unearthed, there's really no way that the kind of motivations that lead you to grow a company can coexist in a sort of decent way with the way that you deal with incarceration. I mean, like, it's just impossible to imagine that going well, right?
Right. And we have just about a minute left. Maurice, what are you working on right now?
So I'm finishing up a long piece about specifically Greg Marcantel, the New Mexico Corrections Secretary, and his experience in Germany. And then I'm starting to do some reporting on suicides in jails, looking at all the different kind of systems of oversight that failed leading up to Sandra Bland's death in Texas.
Yeah, you've got this pretty intense piece about why jails have more suicides than prisons, looking at why suicide is actually on the rise behind bars. And what about you, Michael? Just quickly, what are you working on right now?
Well, I've actually taken a step away from criminal justice specifically for the moment. I'm working on a story about a whistleblower in the Army blowing a whistle on U.S. hostage recovery policy and for Newsweek.
Wow, thank you so much. Maurice Chamaz, a staff writer with the Marshall Project, a nonprofit covering the criminal justice system. And Michael Ames is a contributor to many publications, including Vice and Harper's. Check out their excellent reporting at yourcallradio.org. Michael and Maurice, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Hearing the voices of the people affected by injustice change the way we understand and defend human rights. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with the founders of Voices of Witness, an oral history project and book series that depicts human rights injustices through the stories of the men and women who experience them. How do human stories elevate our understanding of the world we live in? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
On the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI, Noam Chomsky, often called America's leading intellectual, explores hidden meanings behind common phrases. Columnist David Brooks of the New York Times shares his new book, The Road to Character. And filmmaker Robert Kinner shines a light on paid pundits in a new documentary. On the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI.
Tavis Smiley, today at noon right here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco Local Public Radio. You can find us online at kalw.org. World Have Your Say from the BBC is coming up next. It was recorded 1 hour earlier for broadcast now right here on your local public radio station, KALW San Francisco. The time is 11 o'clock.